Okay, good morning. So today we're going to wrap up with the simulation topics and then next week get back to queuing analysis. And so last time we were looking at how we could interpret the output of simulations. And observe that for the sorts of things we're looking at where randomness is involved, observing a single run or aspect of behavior is not necessarily that informative. You have to look at a number of runs. And so what we can do is for each one, we can try and estimate some sort of steady state parameter, mean, variance, percentile, and to some extent distribution. And then we try and reason about how close our estimate is to the actual value. Okay. So this reasoning involves confidence intervals associated with confidence levels. Okay, so a confidence interval is built around your estimate, and we say that within the confidence level, it is, you know, some percentage where the actual value should be in that interval. There were some issues with what good estimators are, and a requirement was that they should be unbiased, so at least the mean value should be the system mean. Okay, so we have a relatively short lecture today. Just finishing up on these simulation ideas. And as promised in the first lecture, we're going to return to the idea of input modeling and examining when sample values, sequences of random variates adhere to various distributions. Okay. So, again, this is the references are Harry Peros and then Banks. Okay. Okay, so how do we choose input models for a system? So particularly, how do we say something, you know, what sort of randomness do we want to attach to our input? And typically, you either pick some sort of distribution, and you pick that distribution based on expert knowledge, so knowledge of what various distributions represent, and what you know about the system that you're actually trying to study. So again, we've discussed why, for instance, exponential interarrival times are reasonable, for a queue are reasonable. So yeah, a queue you're simulating, you might start with exponential interarrival times. Maybe you know something else about your system that says that that's not the appropriate first model. Okay, the second method is that we might be trying to model a real system, and so we might have observed real data, so we might have input from a real-life system. And then, you know, we're going to want to fit it to some sort of distribution function Your options are you could use a histogram. So if you've got a bunch of sample data points. You might see that there's some sort of pattern in terms of how they fall in into various subsections, and so you could use that again to build up some sort of shape to a curve. And once you had something shaped like this, you know, we know how to generate more points that adhere to that, essentially that shape. Okay. The other option, again, is to look at well-known distributions, a lot of which are designed to model real-life scenarios, and then try and fit your data to those distributions, which usually comprises of estimating the parameters for those distributions. So if you had a normal distribution, you'd want to know what the, you could examine your data, calculate a mean estimate, a variance estimate, and use that to parameterize your distribution. So the question we're going to ask today is how reasonable is our fit? So if we collect a bunch of numbers, so a bunch of observations, or generate a bunch of observations, how well is it going to actually adhere to the distribution that we think it's going to, that we would like it to adhere to? Okay. So, the technique is, it's something, but you'll see some sort of parallels with what we did yesterday with the confidence interval and the confidence levels. But the difference, the reason it's not exactly the same, is that for confidence intervals, we were setting up our scenarios so that we could assume a distribution specifically that we're adhering to this normal distribution. Now we don't have that luxury. We don't actually know what the underlying distribution of our samples are. Okay, so as I said, there are a bunch of well-known distributions. And a lot of these, again, that were created to represent sort of specific scenarios, specific real-world events. And typically, again, they're parameterized in some fashion, you know, a lot of time by sort of mean values and maybe variances. Okay. So, just to go over a few of them. A binomial models the number of successes in n trials. So, if you are doing coin flipping, what's the probability that you'll get K out of N heads? Geometric is sort of paired with binomial, and it asks how long does it take to get a certain number of successes. So if you want K heads, how many times do you have to flip the coin? In a similar way, Poisson and exponential are paired. So Poisson models the number of independent events that occur in a fixed period of time, and then exponential models the time between events. Okay. And so again, yeah, it's the same pairing as for binomial and geometric. Okay, Erlang models the sum of several exponentially distributed processes. Weibull models the time to failure for components, and it's exponential is actually a special case of Weibull. Normal. It looks at a large sum of components, and log normal looks at products. Okay, so again, if you have a specific system, a factory, and it's a sequence of events, then taking sums is not a bad thing to do. If things are in parallel, maybe taking products isn't a bad thing to do. Okay. There are also, so those, again, would have sort of specific scenarios in mind. There are also sort of curve-fitting type of distributions, ones that you use if you don't have that good a match, but you want to get essentially certain shapes to your distributions. Okay, so gamma models non-negative random variables. Beta models bounded intervals. Uniform, just if you don't know anything, go for uniform. And triangular, again, might be something where you perhaps know a mean, but very little else. Okay. And as we said before, if you have observational values, you can always go for an empirical construction of your distribution. Okay. So, some of these you will come across frequently, others not so much. But I give a list here, and the main thing to observe from our point of view is that, again, we're going to need to estimate some parameters for most of these distributions. Okay, so again, taking normal, the general shape of the curve, but you also know that it has to center around the mean, so you're going to have to estimate the mean, and that it gets thicker or thinner according to the variance, so you need to have some idea of the variance to fully pin down what the curve looks like. And so we see for these other distributions, your parameters are involving an estimate of the mean for Poisson and exponential as well. Okay, and if you look up some of the other ones, you'll see similarly that you're going to have to estimate these sorts of parameters. Excuse me. Okay. So the question that we're going to look at today is that we have, on the one hand, a sequence of variates, random variates. So we have some observed sequence or possibly generated sequence. And how well do we think it's adhering to our to a specific distribution? Okay. So we'll start that by looking at adherence to uniform distributions, and then we'll broaden that out. So basically, we're going to look at two categories of tests. The first one, the chi-square test, just it refers to the values alone. So again, we mentioned that if you have something uniform and you divide your region up into subregions of equal size, you would expect roughly the same amount of variates falling into each of the subregions. Okay. Since it's random, you would not necessarily expect exactly the same number, but you want to, so again, you'd want to know, well, when is it reasonable that, you know, when is the variance reasonable, and when does the variation in occurrences in the different regions sort of indicate you're probably not right about your distribution. Okay, and that's going to be the chi-square test. That says nothing about the sequencing of events or the sequence in which these numbers was generated. If, for instance, you generated 1,000 numbers and they were always increasing, you would probably have a little bit of concern about that as well. So, in addition to just looking at the actual values, there are tests that look at sequencing as well. We'll start by looking at the chi-square test. It's relatively easy to perform. We'll start with the chi-square test for uniform random numbers. Then we'll generalize to other distributions. And again, we'll also look at Wren's tests. Okay, so given some observed numbers, where, again, sequencing for the moment is irrelevant, we're going to use our chi-square test to come to some conclusion about whether we think that they look uniform or not. Again, intuitively, you'd think if they were uniform, they'd be fairly evenly distributed throughout the whatever regions you defined. Okay, so we look at a specific set of numbers, and again, ask the question: do they seem to be evenly distributed? So looking at the chi-square test, we divide our interval 0, 1 into a number of equal length subintervals. In each of those subintervals, again, we'll expect roughly the same number of occurrences. Okay. So if you have n intervals and k numbers, you'd expect roughly k over n per interval. Since it's random, you're not going to get exactly that. And so what chi-squared is it gives a way of sort of making a decision as to whether the variance, the deviation from exactly k over n is significant or not. Okay. So, for our example, we choose 10 subintervals. I should have said that if we look at that, we have 10 rows. And I hope 10 rows and 10 columns, so we have 100 samples altogether. And so we can go ahead and find out how many samples are in each subinterval. Okay. And we get these 8, 10, sometimes it's actually okay, 12, 14 is about the farthest away that we get. We also know what we would expect, which again is the k over n. Okay, so 100 divided 10 ways is 10. So you'd, ideally you'd get 10 per interval. Okay. So we want to compare our observed versus our expected. So we can take this, just take the difference. Now, if we try and just add up these differences, well, since they're plus or minus around this average value, you're going to get zero every time. So to actually arrive at a value, we square the difference. Okay, so we now have positive values all the time. So, you see we get, again, different values, but if we look at our the square, we have to think about, well, exactly what it means. Now, in order to do that, we actually have to step away from our uniform distribution for a minute and look at something that's not uniform. Okay, so this is somewhat triangular or normal. It's got some sort of shape where you're much more likely to be in and around the center than you are at the edges. So we've squared our values to sort of indicate the difference between the expected and observed. But what we can see is that it has sort of a different interpretation depending on what your expectation was. So here, we observed 26, got 28, or observed 26 and got 24, or expected 26, got 28, expected 26, got 24. So the difference of 2 means that you're actually pretty close to the mean still. If you look at here, or here, a difference of 2 means you're actually a lot farther away from what you would have expected as a percentage. Okay. So here you have 12/13 of the expected value. Here you only have half what you would expect. So there's some sense that you should really weight these differently. And so, indeed, when you're doing this test, what you now do is you divide by your expected value. Now, again, in this case, that doesn't do anything too exciting, because we have the it's the same expected value always. Okay, but we do that, and then we add up all of the values we get for each of the intervals, and it gives us again some numerical measure of how far what we observed was from what we expected. And so now what we need to do is say, well, is that good or bad? And so the chi-square test is a way of us reasoning about whether that is a good value or a bad value. Okay. So again, intuitively, the smaller we are, the better, the happier we are. But we don't know how far we're deviating from expectation because we don't have a normal distribution. But it can be shown that we have these observed values adhere to a chi-square distribution, hence a chi-square test. Okay. So this chi-square distribution is dependent on degrees of freedom. And your degrees of freedom generally are the number of intervals you choose and minus 1. Again, if you observe n minus 1, you know what's in the last one. Okay, so it's fixed once you've made your n minus, once you have data for n minus 1. Also, subtract off the number of parameters you've estimated. Again, they're being estimated using the observations, so you're, again, pinning down your data using that. And then observe that the more degrees of freedom you have, the closer you come to a normal approximation. So what that says is, like everything, like all the other tests, the more observations you get, the sort of more well-behaved your data, your tests are.
Sorry. I don't think I understand what V stands for. You say it's
That's because you came in late. But we'll go back. Just what I said is we're curve fitting to certain distributions. Say, well, we think our data is exponential. Well, we know what the general form of the exponential is, but there's one parameter we have to estimate the rate. Okay, so lambda. How do we estimate it? We take our observations, we average them, we take one over that average. Okay, so we've estimated one parameter. That parameter is estimated using all this data. Overshot. Where are we? So, again, degree of freedom is, you know, how many values can you sort of play with, pick, before all the other ones are fixed. Okay. So if you're looking at uniform, 0, 1, if you have 10 intervals, you fix 9 of them, you know what has to go in the 10th. So that's where the minus 1 comes from. So the parameter estimates, again, they're another equation dealing with the same unknowns. So if you're estimating parameters, you have to, you're decreasing your degrees of freedom. Okay. So again, if you're looking at different distributions, you'll have a certain number of parameters that you estimate. Exponential, you estimate lambda. Normal, you estimate the mean and the variance. So in both those cases, you'd have to take the whatever number of parameters you estimate, you take that off your degrees of freedom. Okay. So, before we had confidence levels and confidence intervals. Now, we have significance and critical values. Okay. And the interpretation is that your significance is the probability that you calculate a value that's above our critical value, our chi-square value, and yet your sequence still adheres to whatever distribution we were comparing it to. So, again, since these things are random, you could observe values that were all in one interval. There's some small probability then that it's actually still uniform, but it's just not that likely. Okay. So you can think of being above this value as being in the sort of not likely territory. Okay. So when we run this test, what we conclude is, so we pick our significance. That gives us a critical value. We compare the value we calculate to that critical value. And then if we're below the critical value, we conclude that, you know, we're happy. We conclude that we are adhering to a uniform distribution. Okay, and we'll at the end, we'll say a few words about that exact interpretation. Okay. So if we look at our example, we can pick a significance level of 5%. We have 9 degrees of freedom, and we have 10 regions, and minus 1 just because. And we go to some table that we find on the internet, and we see that if you look at 9 degrees of freedom and significance of 0.05 or 5%, then your critical value is 16.919. Okay. And 3.4 is a lot lower than that, so we're happy. We conclude that our sequence is uniform. Okay. Okay. So that's I think that it's quite an intuitive test. Again, we'll extend it to other shapes, but you can see what you do for the other shapes. You just again compare, the likelihood of different, again, you're just comparing to the mean anyway. Okay. Okay. So, again, you want to be a bit careful about choosing intervals relative to your samples. You would like have a fair few samples to compare, and depending how many samples, again, you're going to you would also like to choose intervals so you have a reasonable number of samples per interval. And so this is just what Banks suggests. So if you've got really small number of samples, again, it's gonna be hard to say anything about it, so don't use it. And then again, you want typically to make sure that you expect at least 5 samples per interval. Okay. So before, again, just looking at other distributions, we're going to also look at now sequencing of samples. Okay, and what I've done here is I've just rearranged the numbers we had before. If you, for instance, read across the rows, does anybody observe anything about the values? Yeah. So, obviously, I just did this to make the point, but for each row, all the values are increasing. So, if you think of the sequence as being row, next row, then you have this funny pattern of exactly 10 numbers going up, then exactly 10 numbers going up again, exactly 10 numbers going up again. Okay. Looking at chi-square, it's the same numbers, so there's nothing wrong with it. But again, that's a very peculiar pattern for genuinely random numbers to have. Okay, so in order to say anything about it, well, we have to have some idea of what we would expect to observe, and then again, what we actually are observing, and compare it to exactly what we're observing. Okay. So Runs tests examine the properties of the sequences of the numbers. And so, again, you're going to want to compare what you observe to what you would expect to get. Okay. So you can count the number of runs. So typically the runs that we count would either be runs up, runs down. So how many times do we increase? How many times do we decrease? We might look at the length of those runs, and we might all, we can count the number of runs, look at the length of the runs, and also sometimes runs either above or below a mean. Okay. So the things that we look at again are how many runs do you get of a certain type, and what's the average length of those runs. So, if we look at runs up and down, obviously the number of runs you can get is bounded by how many observations you have, and so the maximum number of runs both up and down is, n minus 1. Okay. The minimum number of runs is 1. If, again, the sequence is random, then we would expect a certain distribution on that count. And we would expect a certain average and a certain variance. And if we observe enough samples, we would expect the distribution to be approximately normal. So if we look at our second example where, you know, I've made the rows so that they go up, you have 10 runs up, all of length 10, no runs down, and so you get a certain mean and a distribution and a variance. Okay. And so this gives you the distribution you would expect. And our actual value is 10. And we can observe that the value of 10 is 13.48 standard deviations away from our mean. Okay. Which doesn't actually. That's about right. Okay. So again, if you're thinking about normal distribution, we encompass 90 whatever percent within 2 standard deviations. So being 13 standard deviations away is really unlikely. Okay. So we would have reasons to suspect that sort of a pattern. Okay, and so you can do a similar thing for runs above or below the mean. And again, if you satisfy, you should be able to, you'll be able to calculate a mean for your distribution, standard deviation for your distribution. And if you have sufficient entries, you should be able to calculate the distribution again will be approximately normal. Okay. So, again, you can calculate your observed value and decide where that fits within distance from the mean. Okay. So if you have, if you look at runs lengths, then you have, you can observe the number of runs of length of any given length. And depending on what you mean by what length, what runs you're actually counting, what run lengths you're actually counting, you can define the expected value that you, the number you would expect to see. Okay. Since you have an observation plus an expected value, you can apply the chi-square test. And again, use that test to arrive at conclusions with significance and levels. Okay. What the expected value is a bit complex. So that's for runs up and down, and this is for runs above and below the mean. So I promise you I've absolutely never asked you to reproduce those formulas in an exam situation, but or even use them in an exam situation. But yeah, just again, that's the approach, and you could say certainly apply it, sort of given a little bit of quiet and time. Okay. So, again, the takeaway from that is that it's not just the values that you get that are important, but actually the sequencing as well that matters. So what we've looked at so far is random numbers, so things that we thought would be uniform, 0, 1. And again, there's no reason not to apply the same techniques to other distributions as well. Okay. So, yeah. Obviously, we aren't always uniform, so if we have another distribution, we'd like to use the same reasoning. Okay. So, if we, so we can apply the chi-square test, and there's just one slight change. And that's it works better if you have roughly the same amount of samples for each interval, and in particular you don't want to get intervals with no samples in them. So again, if something's not uniform, then you know, as you get if you have something that's decreasing, as you get towards the tail, you're going to have trouble getting your samples in if you take the fixed sample sizes. You also have the issue of if your distribution is infinite, then again, you can't actually just divide it up into even intervals because you need a finite, you only have a finite number. So what we do in that case is we adjust the interval size so that we have essentially the same, so that we add the same expected number of values per interval. Okay, so that just fell for the uniform. You pick equal sizes and it fell out that your expected values were the same. Now we're going to have to sort of examine our distribution and do something to the interval sizes to try and even it out. Again, that may or may not be that easy. In some cases, you'll just sort of do your best. And again, the test, because it allows for, the chi-square test still allows for different expected numbers, so you can still deal with it. Okay, and so for some reason, this is N now instead of B, but again, most of these distributions have parameters attached, so you'll have to reduce your degrees of freedom appropriately. Okay, so we have another set of data here, another set of observations. So we have 50 samples now, and we'd like to see, does it really look exponential? Again, exponential, you have to estimate lambda, so we'll have to use our observed values to make that estimate. Okay. So our estimate is 1 over the sample mean, and so if we go and average all our values and take 1 over, we get some sort of value for lambda hat, our estimate. Okay, we want to choose our intervals so that we have equal probability of being in any given interval, equal, so that the expected value in each interval is equal. And so we just decide we want 8 intervals. And so we want the probability of 1/8 of falling in any given interval. Okay. So you can determine that using the CDF. So for each, so we can pick the endpoints. So that again, we're successful. So P is our probability that we want, and for each successive endpoint, we want to add P. So we add 1/8 to that. You have to solve then for the endpoints. Okay. And so I didn't actually throw in the values, but that's okay. Oh, I did throw in the value, so... Okay, so these are the intervals that you would get. So that's the endpoints you would get by trying to take in another 1/8 and another 1/8 each time. So, we count our observations, how many are in each interval. Out of the 50, again, we would expect an equal amount in each, so 1/8 of 50 is 6.25. And we calculate our the difference squared divided by the expected value. And finally, observed chi-square. So, again, we now want to see whether that seems likely or not. Again, that's a fairly significant deviation from what you'd expect. Okay. So how many degrees of freedom do we have? Well, it's n minus 1 plus, minus the parameter that we estimated, so we have 6 degrees of freedom. And we choose our significance level the same. And, that gives us a value of 12.592, which, again, is a lot smaller now than our chi-square value. So we conclude that probably we're not exponentially distributed. Okay. So that's the main takeaway for the lecture today. Just I'll leave you with one thing to sort of ponder, and that's which bears upon exactly our conclusions that we're making for when using the chi-square test. Okay. Okay. So what we've been doing is right now is what's called hypothesis testing. And basically a hypothesis is an assumption that we're making about our system, and what we're trying to do is reason about whether that assumption is correct or not. Okay. So in terms of terminology, we have what's called a null hypothesis, and that's just the hypothesis where we assume that nothing out of the ordinary is happening. Okay. So for the chi-square, our null hypothesis is that the underlying distribution of the sample is a certain distribution. So say it's the uniform distribution. And we typically label that hypothesis H0. There's always, for any hypothesis, there's the negation of the hypothesis. So the negation of our hypothesis is that the sample is not uniformly distributed. Okay. So what we'd try to do is come up with tests that allow us to reason about our hypotheses. And so a hypothesis test is a procedure that allows us to either accept our hypothesis or reject it. Okay. And we may be correct or incorrect about doing this. So, if you think about what you're doing, is you have your hypothesis. It's either true or not true. You test it, and you either reject it, or you don't reject it. Okay. So that's 4 possibilities. So your hypothesis could have been true and you didn't reject it, so that's a good case. Your hypothesis could have been true but you rejected it, that's an error. Your hypothesis could have been not true, but we accepted it. Again, that's not good. Or our hypothesis could have been not true, and we indeed came to that conclusion. So what we need to reason about, so we end up with two types of errors. Either the hypothesis was correct, but we rejected it. We call that a type 1 error. Or the hypothesis was not correct, but we accepted it. We call that a type 2 error. And ideally what we'd like to do is be able to reason about the probability of both type 1 and type 2 errors. Okay. Now, if we looked at our test, our significance level is representing the probability that we made a type 1 error as we rejected our hypothesis, even though it was actually true. Okay, so when we get these big numbers, we reject, but again, we have some small probability that that actually was true. So what we'd like is, again, to have pairs of hypotheses so that if one is true, then the other one is false, so that rejection of one implies acceptance of the other. So if we could reason about both of them again, we'd have a full picture of what was going on. Okay. The problem is that it's typically not possible to test both hypotheses. Okay. So we have our hypothesis, our underlying distribution is uniform. And we have a test for accepting or rejecting that. The other is it's not uniform, and we don't really have any way of testing that. Of just essentially. If it's not uniform, it can be, well, anything but uniform, and how do you reason about that? Okay. Now, type 1 errors for H0 are type 2 errors for H1, and vice versa. So, if we could calculate, if we could test H1, then we would have a complete, we would know the probability of both type 1 and type 2 errors for our original null hypothesis. Okay. Again, the problem is that we can't necessarily test H1. Okay, so that's a bit of a, that takes some thinking about, but if we just look at, so accept that and look at our chi-square test. Okay, so our hypothesis was that we had a certain value, and essentially what we're doing is we're reasoning, again, about type 1 errors. So what's the probability of rejecting when we should have accepted it? Okay. The issue is that what, at least the way I formulated it before, was that I said, accept it if your value is less than this critical value. And this is actually equivalent to trying to determine the type 1 errors for the null hypothesis, okay? Or, sorry, excuse me, for the converse hypothesis, so for H1. Okay. So, we actually came to an action that's relating to our H1, or, you know, again, to type 2 errors for our null our original hypothesis without actually having calculated those. Okay. And so, generally, it's not possible to calculate them. Generally, the values for type 2 errors are higher. But again, what was argued is that if sort of there's, you know, if you have enough samples, there is a certain symmetry starts to appear, and also that if you take it in conjunction with your other tests, that it's you know, sort of close enough. So anyway, that's just a little less almost philosophical point I'll just leave you to ponder. Okay, so having said that, again, it's, you know, in general, you know, things like chi-square tests are used, and people are happy enough to come to the conclusion that if things are, you know, again, samples are roughly in line, then, you know, it's reasonable to assume that actually it's good enough. Okay, so, again, we've looked at the chi-square test for all sorts of distributions, and, yeah, it's easy enough to apply. So, that's all we'll do today. And again, we'll return next week and return to queuing, and we'll start looking at the steady state results in queuing theory. So have a good weekend, and I'll see you guys next week.